The WLEW, News and Public Affairs Department, now presents What Do You Think? Here's your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
Good morning. It is currently about 7 minutes past 10 o'clock, and our guest in the studio today is Michael Dascom. He is the new district conservationist for Huron County, just arrived before the holidays, and trying to introduce him to the thumb and let people know he's here and going to be helping people out in the area. Thanks for being with us. Welcome to the thumb.
Thank you, Craig. Really appreciate it, and I appreciate this opportunity to introduce myself on air here, and looking forward just to jumping in to the area and getting to know folks and their production practices, and just hoping I can help out, lend a helping hand.
Well, where did you come from? So people know that they might notice you have a little bit of what we would consider an accent
okay.
here. Probably not back home for you, but...
This is normal, isn't it? but yeah, I'm from Holly, Colorado. So it was quite a move. 2 days, a pretty long drive. Holly, Colorado is in the southeastern part of the state. So I don't know if any of your listening audience had been through Holly. I'm sure not too many folks, but if you had, it's a small town, 4 miles from the Kansas line, and about 60 miles from the Oklahoma line. So in the southeast portion of the state, there's about 1,200 people in the district, which covered a couple towns. So that kind of tells you the population kind of size and scale of the area. The district that I covered was about 3/4 of Huron County, I'd say. So,
but you were telling me before the show here that it looked a whole lot different than Huron County. It was quite arid and not a lot of lush green crops to be found.
Yes, you bet. Here, especially the last 2 years, we were declared a disaster area. And I know a large portion of the country been struggling through this drought, this persistent drought. But it definitely hit southeastern Colorado hard. We had 6.6 inches of precip in the last 12 months out of Holly. So that tells you, I mean, that's snow, that's rain, that's everything in the calendar year last year. So yeah, it was a dry year, to say the least. And the year before that, it was, I think, 8 point something. So yes, it's a semi-arid area. The cropping systems that I'm used to dealing with in that area mainly revolve around a wheat fallow. So we're talking a wheat crop every other year, 30 bushel was the county average, so 30 bushels every other year. That tells you kind of the level of production. We had to have that fallow year in there. And when I mentioned fallow, in this neck of the woods, yeah, folks, it seems like they're very relieved. They don't have to know what that's about because just a lot more productivity here in this area, and that's exciting. I really like seeing the diversity in this area from both the cropping, the type of cropping systems folks can utilize, and also the size and scale of operations. And that's exciting. We have some large operators, we have several smaller and some diverse like niche market type crops, and I look forward to learning more about each of those settings.
Is it all a learning curve? Because I mean, you work in one place and you're used to what they do, and then mm-hmm. you come here and it's totally different. I mean, it would be totally different if you went to Pennsylvania or anywhere else too, but I mean, it's because each area is unique.
You're right. Yeah, you're right. Good point. It is a learning curve, and it is unique, that's for sure. But there are some similarities. Most of our corn, you know, we did raise corn in Prowers County, Colorado, but that was all under irrigation. So some of the inputs and some of the practices that go along with growing that crop, it was definitely different. But wheat fallow was our dry land. We say in here most everything appears to be dry land. I think there's some irrigation, just very limited. In Holly, we had two different types of irrigation systems. We had pump systems that were on the Ogallala Aquifer, right, and pumping depths were from about 200 to 300 feet, and they were dropping as we speak.
Those are wells.
Those are wells, and so under those wells, we'd grow corn was the main irrigated crop, or alfalfa. So similar crops, just different production settings.
And yeah. They had to be done in a way that would be, well, to continue to be profitable.
That's
so
correct.
You had to account for the cost of pumping the wells and everything else to get enough yield. And was it just because you had a local crop and made it easier to sell as opposed to having to ship it in from everywhere else?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And also, I think, some of the cost of land was a lot less, though. Reflect the other increased inputs that you'd have, mainly the pumping costs and the water bill. So energy was a major input there, mainly from pumping costs. If you didn't have, if you weren't on a well situation, we had some surface ditch irrigated acres as well out of the Arkansas River. So there was no pumping cost, but you still had a lot of water use fees associated with that, to maintain the ditch systems. It's an intricate system, and especially in these drought years, there was a lot of folks, they planted certain crops counting on water being there, and then we didn't have the snowpack, and water allocations got cut back. So we said in Colorado, water was for fighting over and whiskey was for drinking. So yeah, that was it was quite stressful, I guess would probably be the word on everybody, on either side of the table, when you're dealing with water, especially in back-to-back disaster years that we had in Colorado. So
you're the district conservationist.
Yes.
What basically does a district conservationist do for the district?
Okay, I'm responsible for NRCS operations in Huron County. Natural Resource Conservation Service. Yep, that's what we stand for. And if you want, I could tell you a little bit about kind of how we're structured. I know oftentimes, in Colorado, I was there 8 years as a district conservationist there. And, there's still folks in the county, even in a small community, that, they wonder, how do you function as NRCS? How does that work with the districts? And if you'd like, I can kind of go over
Sure. Just
a little bit about that.
A little background.
So the Natural Resource Conservation Service, we're a division of the USDA, right? And so USDA, their overarching goal, to summarize it, would be basically they want a thriving agricultural sector, right? And so that's kind of the big picture. And there's several benefits to having a thriving agricultural sector. One of the main ones is, of course, a safe and secure food supply. And then there's also several other benefits, strong rural economies, also energy can be derived from the agricultural sector. So those are all...
We have an ethanol plant in Carroll.
Okay, wonderful.
We have the energy up here, too.
Wonderful, yeah. I think it's great to have that diverse portfolio, in the area. I think that adds to the whole community. And so those are all, public goods, really, that everybody benefits from. So that's the USDA in general. That's their overarching goal. And then as far as NRCS, we just take the natural resource slice of the kind of greater USDA pie. And so we're looking at natural resources and production settings. And our mission at the NRCS is helping people help the land. And I like that because it's simple, number one, but also there's a kind of a call to action there, helping being the action word. I like to say we take the S in NRCS very seriously. That's the service, Natural Resource Conservation Service. So we like to provide the helping hand to folks in the area. So we work to ensure that lands are productive, to ensure that lands are profitable and sustainable, and all while maintaining or improving the environment. We believe that this is possible, that these aren't mutually exclusive events.
Yeah, and if I'm thinking right, you do the things like the filter strips between the ditch and a river, things to kind of buffer getting nutrients that don't necessarily need to get into the river and should stay in the field where you want the crop to get them anyway.
Yes.
From not migrating, and all these types of programs to allow for agricultural practices without impacting non-agricultural areas in the area.
Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right, Craig. Water quality, we often say, we can kind of roll that into water quality as a resource concern, and that's a major resource concern in the area, with several targeted watersheds that affect the Saginaw Bay area, but then just the amount of moisture we have, and then you look at the different, from irrigation ditches to rivers to the Great Lakes. Water quality is a major factor, something that we factor into all of our programs and rankings and things like that. Water quality was definitely an issue in every state, you know, across the country, but in Holly, Colorado, where it was so dry, it was more of a quantity type concern versus the quality. Like, for instance, this summer, the Arkansas River, I don't know if everybody knows this, but, you know, it does run dry in Kansas, about 60 miles inside Kansas. It the Arkansas River runs dry for about 150 miles, maybe. And that's just normal. Historically.
Was that normal before everybody was taking water out for irrigation and stuff, or is this kind of something we really created ourselves?
Anyway? Well, I think there's a combination of things. It's been that way for a long time. I have seen historical pictures of, say, in Garden City, Kansas, where they had bridges and there was people walking over the bridge because their water was flowing there. And that would be about 100 miles inside of Kansas. So it has flowed that, I think, in the past. But I don't know if that was just after major, spring runoff events, storm events. I'm not quite for certain, but that's the way it is these days. However, this last summer, it ran dry through Holly. I have pictures of a dry creek bed. And there's a lot of old-timers from the area said they'd never seen that before. So basically, water quality, basically, if you don't have much water, the quality was not as much on the forefront, I'd say, as it is here, of course. We definitely have to factor that into everything. So, yeah, some of the practices you mentioned, that's exactly what we're dealing with. We work with private landowners and stakeholders, we often say, partners, and we provide assistance in the form of both technical and financial assistance, and that's to help them care for the land, and we do that by encouraging beneficial stewardship practices, basically. And the NRCS has identified three priority areas where we want to encourage these stewardship practices. The one priority area is high quality and productive soils, right? And so in general, we're looking to protect soils from erosion, of course. And we want good soil structure.
And that's where cover crops and things come in, because anytime you've been around here, when you had a big windstorm and they just harvested and stuff, I mean, your car gets sandblasted as you're driving down the road. And we don't want to give it to Canada.
Yeah,
we
there you go.
Keep it here.
There you go. I want to keep real estate in place where it's meant to be. You bet. And that's still a challenge everywhere. And so that is one of our main goals. Coming from Holly here after the dry year we had, there was a few days where we had some major wind events here before I left, before Christmas, and yeah, there was some scenes. I could have took some pictures where it looked like scenes out of that Dust Bowl documentary, if anybody watched that here around Thanksgiving time. It's still an issue, and so we definitely want to try to conserve cover, and these cover crops and some of these practices can help do that.
Because soil just doesn't happen. It takes time to develop.
Yes.
And if you start skimming it off a little bit every year beyond what nature and your practices can maintain, and pretty soon you're going to be in sand, clay, and everything else, and nothing's going to grow.
You're right. That topsoil, that's our most productive layer, and we need to maintain that. It does take a long, long time to develop, and so we want to keep that in place and have that to our benefit. And so we talk about trying to maintain good soil structure, and that's more than just holding the plant upright. And we say, that's we really need that good soil structure so that we can have a properly functioning soil system, and that's really the basis of all of our production.
It's a balance. The soil has to be strong enough to hold the plant, but not so strong that it crimps the roots off and can't get any
that's correct
growth or moisture. So and that can vary between what kind of plants you're trying to plant.
Mm-hmm,
you need corn, you need it to hold it up straight better, and a low-growing plant like soybeans, not so much of a problem there. You just want to make sure that you've got the nutrients you need.
Nutrients, yeah. And you're managing pore spacing and air so it can travel through the soil. And really we talk about soil health is what that ultimately falls into. That's soil health is kind of a movement, I guess you'd say, in the country, and definitely something NRCS is focused on. And there's several benefits for managing for soil health. What we're looking at is not just the above ground productivity, but managing the herd, we say, below the soil. And so we're talking microbes and earthworms and other soil biology. We want to ensure that they're thriving and functioning. And there's several benefits
We can do without the rumors and stuff.
But yeah, yeah. There's definitely there's those pests in there that we do want to manage for or against. But all the beneficial biology, it's a benefit to have that functioning well. And so we actually have a few folks from our office that are headed out today for a no-till conference in Indianapolis, and I think there's several producers from the area that are heading down there as well, and they're going to be talking about no-till but also it's a lot broader than that. It's about some of the latest cutting-edge production practices and research, and then soil health, and talking about how we can have really a properly functioning system. And like I say, there's several benefits if we're managing for the herd beneath the surface. We're increasing our nutrient cycling. We're reducing inputs like from commercial fertilizers, and also reducing energy use. So we have
people managing that GPS today. They know the south end of the field needs more nitrogen than the northeast side, and when they get in the tractor to apply it, the machine tells it exactly where it is positioned from global positioning in space, and applies the correct amount in the correct area, so it balances out, and you're saving on the cost of what nutrients you're putting in there, and it's not going to run off as much.
There you go. We're not over applying in some areas, or maybe under applying in others. We're much more exact. RTK, real-time kinetics, they call it, a sub-inch accuracy on some of this placement, and variable rate application equipment, where it can go from your yield monitor to your planter, to your fertilizer, and it'll adjust the rates accordingly. So yeah, it's some really neat technology, and that's definitely something that we encourage with our programs.
And it increases the efficiency of how much food we produce dollar for dollar, because you're not wasting money on fertilizer you don't need. You're not planting more seed than you need because you know it's going to grow. You don't have to plant twice as much and then pull half of it out because some places it grew and some places it didn't. I mean, you know what's going to happen, at least better than you used to.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. And kind of along those lines, the Conservation District offers a pre-side dress nitrate soil testing service in the spring. So before you apply your nitrogen fertilizer, for example, if you pull a soil test, for $7.25, you can do a soil test that can account for up to 20 acres. And we'll run that soil test and look to see if there's any excess nitrogen or what the nitrogen budget would be. So before you apply, let's find out if there's any credits that you have. And by and large, I'm looking at 2012 numbers from last year's testing. Countywide, we saved an average of $81 per acre for folks that participated in that program. And that comes from a end credit that was already there. So there was already $81 worth of N using the going rate for per pound of N. I think it was 64 cents per pound of N on average, and that saved folks dollars. It saved on, they didn't have to provide that input, and then we weren't overloading the soil to where then we could create some of these water quality issues down the road. So it was a real benefit, something folks should think about this year as well.
And it's not just extending, the fertilizer you buy, it's the fertilizer you may have on hand from your cattle and such.
That's
manure
true.
is a great natural fertilizer, but if you only throw it all onto one field, that field's got too much and the rest don't. It's learning how much you need to put on each and to get the best results from your total acreage.
Yes, yep, great point. That's exactly what we try to encourage, apply it at agronomic rates and manure mineralizes at different rates, different times of year, soil temperature, air temperature. And so, yes,
and
it's something to factor.
Applying is different than injecting. There's all kinds of things going on that can change. If you inject, all of it's in the ground. If you surface apply, some of it, we end up smelling next door.
You might have some volatilization that you smell. Yeah, and you're losing some of that.
That's
in.
That's a nice way to put it, volatization. Yeah. We have other words for it that we can't say on the radio.
Gotcha. Yeah, but you're right. Well, interesting, in Holly, Colorado, we said we were manure poor. We didn't have very many feedlot settings or dairies. There's no dairy in the county.
But it used to be around here, people kind of almost thought of it as a waste byproduct, but it's a valuable asset now.
Yes, you're right. There you go. Yep. Using it correctly and applying it to agronomic rates, it's a wonderful thing to incorporate. You know, it's great for, kind of comes back to this whole soil health discussion we were having, in that those microbes, you know, that's a wonderful food source for them is that manure. And so, yeah, it's something that we try to, you know, encourage.
I think you're going to shock farmers to tell them that there's a place actually where there's a shortage of manure.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. If we could just truck it out there. Yeah, kind of just a funny joke we used to say.
And we have one CAFO that could probably supply your whole needs in
there'd be an interest out there if you're listening. And I say that because we used to joke, and you know, in Prowers County, Colorado, we'd take anything you can give us. We even took sludge from New York City. Biosolids was trucked out to that area for years and years and years. Actually, that program just ended. But you bet. Yeah, we were hurting for some excess nutrients.
Liquid gold, but not gold.
Yeah.
You have, but you do these types of things. Mm-hmm. You do the filter strips, all the other things, but you're also helping farmers become better stewards of the land.
Yes.
Because that's their biggest asset for their farm.
It is.
Is their property. You know, it supports the cattle, it supports the crops, it supports their life.
Yes. Yes.
And to preserve it is preserving their life.
It's a good point. Yes, profitable and productive and sustainable. Those are our main goals. And you know, if you're not profitable, you're not going to be sustainable. Not productive, not going to be sustainable. And so that is something that we try to encourage through these practices. And we have some programs that we kind of talked about that we offer to help with that. And you know, one of our programs is a technical program. We call it CTA. We have all kinds of acronyms, and it's hard for us to keep it all straight at times, but it's Conservation Technical Assistance. Basically, we can come out, do site evaluations, get you any current information that we can to help you with planning your operation and helping determine what your needs and your goals are. So that's something we offer to anybody. You don't need a contract for that.
And people shouldn't be worried that, you know, if you come up with a plan, they have to institute it. They have to find it's cost effective, that's right for them.
Yes.
I mean, you're just offering the advice.
Yeah, basically. You're right. Absolutely.
It's not a mandate from the government, because the government's been here. People worry about that.
Yeah, no, and that's valid. It is. But we're happy just to help, to lend what advice we can. And you could use that, you know, how you see fit. Yeah, there's no contract involved with that. We do have some contract programs where there's financial assistance involved, and we can work with you to find what program works best for your situation, for the time frame. We have some programs are offered at certain times of the year, and so you know, maybe if we have an application for some of these practices we mentioned, it might fit at a certain time of the year into one program. Maybe we tweak it a bit and have it fit in another program. I often like to say we like to have several arrows in our quiver, so we can help you reach your goals, you know, and use what program is available at the time. Or maybe we'd be looking at another program coming up down the road. So
usually when there's financial gain in it from the government, though, there will be strings then. You'll have a time period that you're signing up for these types of things.
Yes, yes. And looking into the programs and even in applying, you're not committed to anything. It's not till, you know, you sign the contract and dot a line, and we'd explain what that it would entail and what's going to be required of you. And so there's some things that doesn't require a whole lot of effort on your part. There's others that would, you know, require substantial, but that would all be laid out up front. But you know what's interesting, these cost share programs I was going to mention, it's unique, I'd say, for federal agencies to be able to channel federal dollars onto private land. That's something that's unique to the NRCS. Most federal agencies, they use those funds on their own land. Let's say Forest Service, that goes to Forest Service land. BLM goes to BLM land. But here we can work with private landowners. And the reason we can do that is because we have these conservation districts in place. And so here locally, we have the Huron County Conservation District. They're great folks. They have several great programs, very proactive. We have a board of directors. And basically, they provide the local leadership to ensure that we are addressing these resource concerns and opportunities in the area. And so they help direct programs. And basically the conservation district, I often say it's a symbiotic relationship between the NRCS and the conservation district in that we each need one another. They're mandated by Congress to be in place to help ensure that local resources are being, concerns and opportunities are being addressed. That was installed after the Dust Bowl days, I think through the New Deal, I believe.
Well, after the Dust Bowl, I think Washington got an idea that we need to protect this.
Yes.
We were hurting bad.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so these districts were put in place, and now by working through the districts, we can funnel these program dollars through the districts out to private landowners. And so a couple of those programs we have are EQIP, another acronym, Environmental Quality Incentives Program. It's one of our main programs here in Huron County, so several folks listening, I'm sure, have participated. And hopefully there's some more improvements or practices you'd like to install. We'd sure love to work with you. And we have an application period going on. It's year-round application. However, we're batching those. We have a cutoff date put in place so that we can commence the first round of funding for 2012 here next month. So by Thursday the 17th, actually, January 17th here, we need all applications in for 2013. And so we can look at...
People have to know you're not looking for their prime land, per se. Many times the pieces you're looking for are a little sliver along a ditch or a creek that it's hard to get into anyway to get any productivity out of. But it'd be perfect for wildlife. It'd be perfect as a buffer between your other great acreage and the ditch and the river there to mitigate transfer of nutrients and such. A lot of these places are you're not talking their prime $8,000 an acre land.
Correct. Yeah, correct. And you're looking at it the same way I look at it. There's opportunities, you know, everywhere. And even if it's more marginal production land, there might maybe to be better served as a filter strip area, like you mentioned, a buffer area, something for wildlife. We have these pollinator plantings we can help with now, where you know we'd identify some different flowering forb species that would flower a few times throughout the growing season, and that would provide for pollinator habitat. And there's a payment for that if you're willing to set aside some of those acres.
So, looking out for the bees.
That's actually another major kind of push. There's several benefits from that. Oftentimes in these pollinator mixes, we'll find they are wildlife friendly, and they are upland. They meet a lot of the food and cover requirements for upland birds as well. So yeah, that's definitely a major shift in some of our programs. And you mentioned like prime land, there are opportunities for that as well. In that we have another program called CSP, Conservation Stewardship Program, and whether it's marginal or whether it's prime land, it could be eligible. CSP creates a 5-year contract. And basically, it's for management practices. We're really not installing anything structural, but what we do is we sit down, we have an interview with the producer, and we determine what benchmark level of conservation they're currently at. And if it's their prime land and they're doing everything that you can do for it, well, that would be a higher benchmark, right? And then if there's other acres where they could, say, enhance is the term we use for CSP, add some enhancements on to try to bring it up to more productive land or more environmentally beneficial land, then they can sign up for additional enhancements. And of course, the more enhancements you sign up for, the more ranking points you have, and then the more ranking points, it eventually translates to potentially some more dollars. So that's an exciting program for folks also. And like I say, it's focusing more on management type practices.
Do you do things with, I know they're trying to, we have a high percentage of land with drain tile. And there's been kind of a push to put like a door on the end of them. They just don't go into the ditch open.
Oh, uh-huh.
If there's
yes.
a door, it tends to help keep some of the nutrients in the field and not finding its way to Saginaw Bay or Lake Michigan.
Yes.
Are these other types of practices that you try to help people with?
Yes. That, and I think... I may be wrong. Like I say, I'm trying to get up to speed here on a lot of these opportunities in a hurry here. But We can, yes, we can help with that. We call it drainage water management. And I've had the opportunity to speak with a couple different producers in the area who recently installed those type of structures. And I think that really became of interest, obviously, for managing water quality issues, but also in the drought year that you guys had here. I don't want to underestimate that. I know it was severe here as well. And so I think trying to save every drop of moisture that we had was of real interest. And putting in those type structures, I've heard them called like stop log structures, or, you know, some sort of a headgate type implement that we could actually stop the flow of that drainage water out of the tile and actually use it to potentially sub irrigate the crops. And so I think in the dry months that we had, that was really a favorable option to help manage what moisture we did have available, because there wasn't any really coming from the sky at that time.
They were put in to keep the fields from flooding, but
yes,
that wasn't a problem last year.
Gotcha.
For the most part.
Gotcha. Yeah, so I think I was reading about that also in a conservation journal I get, and yeah, that's an exciting practice. I've heard nothing but beneficial comments about it, so it's something we'd sure like to encourage and look into more. And the couple producers I spoke to, they sound like they were real happy with that.
Yeah. The less you have to pay to irrigate, and the better your crops do,
yeah,
smiles on the farmers' faces.
Yep, that's right.
So. Now, all of this, this is USDA, is this
mm-hmm.
something that's kind of in flux until we really get a farm bill? Or are a lot of these programs pretty much, they're going to be there?
They are in place right now. We just had the farm bill extended.
Mm-hmm.
So There was some changes we talked about coming with the new farm bill, and basically those are still going to be on hold a bit, and that we just extended the old ones. So that's still in place, and there's several beneficial programs in the old farm bill, which was the 2008 farm bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's pretty much, we're just rolling with the programs as usual. I think there's a few that are still, maybe funds are yet to be obligated. There's authority to issue those programs, but they're not really ones that we deal with on a large basis anyway. Most of the ones we deal with are EQIP, our CSP programs, some of the other more local initiatives. They're still in place, and funds have been allocated for them. So yes, they're available
to
everyone.
Because people have questions, you know, when it comes to the farm bill, and, you know, because you hear some of the programs for getting young farmers going.
Yes.
Kind of took a little hit. They didn't get extended with the rest of it. And, you know, well, but as long as these programs are available, people will take advantage of them and should.
Yes. And we do have some increased cost share for beginning farmer rancher, and I've spoke with some of those folks here in the last week. And so that's something that we'd want to try to focus and help them get off to a good start. There's also several programs that the district offers. I wanted to point out there's some local watershed initiatives that the Huron County Conservation District administers, and basically these are specific to three watersheds in the county: the Seaboing, the Pigeon, and the Pinnebog watershed. Each have their own initiatives, and so each one varies a little bit, but in general, we're looking at applying best management practices that address water quality in these watersheds that flow toward the bay. So that's what we're looking at: filter strips, residue management, leaving residue, cover crops, even some cross fencing to minimize livestock access to open water, things like that, just controlling access. So yes,
and
those are available to the district.
All of this has benefits for people even non-agricultural.
Absolutely.
Because this stuff that they're stopping going in doesn't turn into algae blooms in the bay, doesn't come up on the shore as muck and stuff. It helps all the way around the environment for everybody, not just the farmer.
Yes, you're right. And that's kind of going back to the big picture of USDA. All of our programs, we can apply these programs on private acres, on private land, but there's a public benefit from doing that. So that's something that we want to ensure, and that's why, you know, rather than just applying one practice like a Band-Aid, we want to look at the whole resource concern, and are we addressing that? So that's our goal.
Mm-hmm.
We often talk about there's a new term out there, ecosystem services, which are public goods derived from natural capital stocks. That's the definition. And so really we want a functioning ecosystem so that folks can have these services like healthy, productive lands, like quality non-contaminated water. You know, it comes back to a public benefit, you bet.
Also sounds like some acronyms to come.
Yes. Oh, we're good at generating those. You bet. There's a couple other district programs I just wanted to mention. Mm-hmm. We have a tree sales program, which is going on right now. And I think maybe you had that on the air the other day. But I wanted to let folks know they can come by and order trees. This is a great time to do it. I think they get delivered in April. You can order anytime up till then. But the sooner you get your order in, then the more likely, you know, we won't run out of certain trees. So we have several seedling trees that we offer, conifer seedling trees and hardwoods and fruit trees as well. So either come on by, pick up an order form, or give us a call. We can get one sent out to you. But that's a program that we use funds generated from that program to keep other conservation programs going through the district. We also have some tractors that we rent, equipment rental. 2 30-foot air seeders and 2 15-foot no-till drills are available to rent. So you want to get your name on that list if you're interested in utilizing that equipment this spring.
I assume they're all designed for good farm practices, no-till,
yes,
air seeder. These
yeah.
are things that are designed to fit in with the practices you encourage.
You bet. We're working toward reducing tillage when possible, saving residue when possible. Working toward more diverse crop rotations is something that we push with soil health as well. And then trying to have a living root in the soil for as long a time as possible throughout the year. You know, that living root through photosynthesis, it feeds the plant, but also feeds the soil too. So it all comes back to soil health and cutting down on erosion and a nutrient, increased nutrient cycling, saving on other inputs. So you bet. You know, I mentioned the nitrate testing we do through the district, and something else I wanted to point out also is that we're going to have an open house at the Conservation District next Tuesday, January 15th, from 10 to 3. Lunch will be served throughout that time, so great opportunity to come on by. I'd sure love the opportunity to meet each and every one of you out there. You can meet us, we can meet you, and we can tell you a little bit more about programs. And just be a fun, informal time. So hopefully folks will come out and take advantage of that. Love to see you. January 15th.
Is it a case where these services, the people have to seek them out? You don't go find them for the most part. They have to be interested and seek it out to see if there's a benefit for them by contacting you or the office.
Yes. Yeah. These are all voluntary programs. And so, you know, there's been times when we probably went and visited folks, and that's something I'd like to do. I like to get out on the land and visit with folks, especially being new to the area and new to some of these production systems. I'd sure love the opportunity to get out and see what folks are dealing with and how find out how I can help them meet their goals. So that's something that, yeah, it would be great to be proactive and track folks down. But in reality, you know, if they come to us, even just general, just with a general question or just general want, invitation out to their place, then that's something that, yeah, we love that opportunity and get them involved in some of the programs.
Does it normally take a visit out to the farm? Do you really need to see it to get the real feel of it? I mean, they can come in and say, yeah, I've got 60 acres devoted to this, I got 40 acres, this one's near a river, and you know, but I don't think there's any comparison to just actually seeing it.
Yeah, you bet. Getting out on the land in the field with the producer, that's, you know, they're really the experts on their field and what they're dealing with. So we want to hear it from them. If we can see it, you know, yeah, that definitely helps us develop a better plan. And oftentimes, maybe a producer, they're concerned with one aspect, single aspect on their field. You know, maybe they're aware of an erosion point. They want to take care of that. But then maybe we could look around and we could talk about other opportunities. Like we mentioned, maybe some marginal areas. What can we do there? Or there's several, maybe in the farmstead itself, in the barnyard, there might be some opportunities as well with fuel storage and ag chemical handling type facilities. There might be some practices we want to look at there as well. one priority we have in Michigan, and this is unique to Michigan anyway. I think it's wonderful. There's this MEEP, we call it, verification. So you can MEEP verified, basically as applying best management practices and meeting a certain criteria so that you can be verified. And within our EQIP program, we've actually set aside some funding for MEEP specifically, where if there's just a couple practices that a producer needs to apply to hit to meet that verification requirement, and then we actually have a special fund pool to where they would be considered, and they'd rank a little higher, saying, hey, they've done all this list of great things, they're almost there, they just need some help with one or two practices, and we can help that. So yeah, being out on the farm, visiting with the producer, that often helps us have a complete picture of what the opportunities are.
And I think with most programs, just being there with a person is a whole lot better. There's a whole push to do things on the internet and stuff, and I don't think you can compare to actually talking to somebody, showing them, and all of that.
Yes, yeah, I agree 100%. You're right. There's always more paperwork, and we get plenty of computer time, that's for sure. And so it's always a wonderful opportunity when we can make it out in the field. And that's something that we're going to try to make that a priority. We actually have another employee coming on board next Monday. Caitlin Wagner is going to be a new soil conservationist in the office starting Monday. And so that'll be another employee, a person we can have out in the field, and we can definitely try to make more time for those field visits. So looking forward to that.
And another person to meet at the open house.
There you go. Yes, she'll be there. She'll be starting Monday. So yeah, on her second day in the job, it'll be great. And I've been here 3 weeks now, so I'm still pretty fresh off the boat. And so it'll be a great opportunity for all of us to meet folks in the area.
Well, I thank you for taking time with us today, and welcome to the area again.
Thanks so much, Craig. Really appreciate
it. The county welcomes you, and hopefully you can do a lot of good things for the people here through your organization with the USDA and NRCS.
You bet. Well, thanks.
Acronyms.
Yes, I've already got it. Yeah, you confuse it. Confuses me at times, but yes, thank you. Yeah, appreciate it.
If they have any questions or want answers on some of the programs we talked about here today, they just contact your office?
Yes. If they do that, swing on by, give us a holler, and we can come out and meet you. And yes, look forward to talking about all these opportunities.
And you're out in the office on M53, west of town?
Just west of town, north side of the road there. It's the service center. We're located with FSA and NRCS. We're right across the hall from one another, so kind of a one-stop shop for producers.
Yep. Can't help them in one side of the building, maybe the other side has something they can use.
There you go, we work together.
Again, thanks for being with us today, and I hope you enjoy the area.
Thanks, Craig, definitely we are. Thank you.
Our guest today on the program has been Michael Dascom. He is the district conservationist now for Huron County. Again, you can stop by the office, get info on any of the programs we talked about today, or just stop in next Tuesday and say howdy. Coming up at the top of the hour, we'll clue you in on the latest in news.
AM 1340 WLEW, a proud member of the American Society for the Preservation of Classic Country.
True. answer. And Mama asked me this morning if I'd been by your grave. But that flag and stone ain't where I feel you anyway. I drive your truck.
Couple houses. houses down.
All your favorite country hits and classics from yesterday and today. AM 1340 WLEW, the Thumb's hottest country.
Such a strange situation, stopping every 100 miles, calling Baton Rouge. A replay of last night's events rolled through my mind, except a scene or two erased by sweet red wine. And I see a truck stop sign ahead, so I change lane. I need a cup of coffee and a couple dollars change. Put me on through, I gotta send my love down to Baton Rouge. Hurry up, won't you put her on the line? I gotta talk to the girl just one more time.
Good morning, it is 11 o'clock here at AM 1340 WLEW Bad Axe, Michigan. Your news update is being brought to you by your electrical specialists of the Thumb area, Maurer Electric of Bad Axe. For all your electrical needs, see Maurer Electric in Bad Axe. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo will be pushing for a ban on assault weapons as he delivers his State of the State address this afternoon. In the aftermath of last month's school massacre in Connecticut, Cuomo and his fellow Democrats who led the state assembly are looking to ban all assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition magazines. The mental state of James Holmes may be the focus of much of the remaining part of the preliminary hearing in Colorado. Defense lawyers say they could present witnesses to describe the mental health of the man accused of killing 12 people at a movie theater last July. The New York Fire Department says 30 to 50 people are being evacuated for possible injuries after a ferry struck a dock during rush hour in Lower Manhattan. News reporters say the ferry from Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey, banged into the mooring as it arrived in Manhattan. Some passengers were carried away on gurneys to await ambulances. A group of 48 Iranians, freed by Syrian rebels after months of captivity, have arrived at a Damascus hotel. Officials say they were released after President Bashar Assad's regime promised to free hundreds of detainees in the first major prisoner swap of the country's civil war. Rebels claimed the captives were linked to Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guard, but Tehran has denied that. Stocks are rising on Wall Street after U.S. corporate earnings reports got off to a strong start. Alcoa rose after predicting rising demands for aluminum this year. Late Tuesday, the company reported fourth quarter revenue that beat analysts' forecasts. We'll be right back after this.
If you're building new, or you found that classic turn-of-the-century dream house that you've always wanted to remodel into your pride and joy showplace, you're going to need new wiring. For your best price and the most efficient work, call the experts at Maurer Electric and Bad Axe. Rewiring an older home can be a real challenge. The professionals at Maurer Electric can offer the best advice and service to make a messy job less stressful. Maurer Electric also sells generators and electric motors.
This is Larry Maurer. If honesty and integrity matter to you, call us at Maurer Electric and Bad Axe at 989-269-8171. We'll treat you right.
A doctor says two of four suspected escorts found dead in Detroit in 2011 likely died from asphyxiation. Dr. Francisco Diaz is the first witness Wednesday at a court hearing to determine if James Brown of Sterling Heights will stand trial on four counts of first-degree murder. Diaz performed autopsies on the bodies of Renisha Landers and Damisha Hunt. He says he found no evidence of trauma, but believes they died of asphyxiation, a lack of oxygen to the brain. The bodies were found in the trunk of a car. Brown is charged in Macomb County, where the deaths are alleged to have occurred. At least three of the four victims promoted themselves as escorts for hire on Backpage.com, which carries classified and personal ads. Police say a woman crossing a road has been struck and killed by a hit-and-run driver in suburban Detroit. A Macomb Daily of Mount Pleasant reports the woman was hit about 10:15 p.m. Tuesday in East Point. Police are looking for a small silver vehicle. Police say the woman was taken to the hospital, where she died. Police are seeking witnesses to the accident and tips in the case. A shed fire sent the Pigeon Fire Department to a house on Caseville Road Tuesday night. The shed belongs to local resident Sid Smith, who rents the house to others. It is said that the shed somehow caught fire while the renters were burning trash. The extent of the damage and a dollar estimate of the loss have not been formally announced. I'm Johnny on the radio for your WLEW News. For the latest Thumb Area news anytime, go to thumbnet.net. This update is brought to you by your electrical specialists of the Thumb Area, Maurer Electric of Bad Axe. For all your electrical needs, see Maurer Electric and Bad Axe.